Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 159, recorded April 17th, 2013. Greetings, everyone. Kelly is unable to join us tonight, so I hope you'll bear with me. We have quite a lineup today. We've got Scott in Fort Worth, Texas, Tom in Provo, Utah, Bob in Boston, Mick in Carnforth, UK, and Kelly in Shrewsbury, UK. So let's start out with Scott in Fort Worth. He says, I heard the show and appreciate the information about blueberry shrimp. You mentioned that there are a number of blue shrimp that get tagged as blueberry shrimp. As I've researched, I found several blue varieties, some of which are extremely expensive. I've considered buying them from the Bailey Brothers at aquariumfish.net, as they don't seem to be readily available in the local fish stores. As you guys recommended, I've provided a link and a pic below. The scientific name provided is Neocaridina heteropoda, and that is the currently accepted scientific name applied to red cherry shrimp as well, for the information of those of you who might wonder about that. And I'll put the link up on the show page if you'd like to check that up. Check that out, the link that Scott has sent. He continues, I look forward to any additional information this might help you to provide and appreciate you trying to find a dwarf cichlid expert. Okay, well, let's address a couple of things relating to the scientific name first. Now, it'll be hard to determine which one it actually is, whether it's palmata or heteropoda, but it doesn't really matter because both species would interbreed with red cherry shrimp, given the chance, and so you'd want to keep them separate. And both of them have similar husbandry requirements. So I would say that the ones that the Baylor Brothers offer, I visited the link that you provided, and that looks like a pretty good strain there. It looks like a nice, brightly colored strain, certainly. I would say it's probably safe to go with that and just make sure you don't keep it with other species in that genus, and you should be fine. They seem to be, from what I can determine, approximately as prolific as red cherry shrimp, maybe not quite as much, but somewhere along those same lines in terms of care, maybe a little bit more delicate, but not anything that you couldn't deal with if you've already kept red cherry shrimp. So that's probably a pretty safe bet, although they are quite expensive. And I would recommend starting out with at least, you know, eight or so to make sure that you have a little bit of you have a good chance, first of all, getting a number of males and females, and then you want some genetic diversity there. You don't want to found the population with one individual. And, yeah, in terms of the dwarf cichlid expert, we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but hopefully, Scott, that was helpful. And though I have not ever purchased anything from the Bailey Brothers, I have corresponded with them to some degree, and I think you probably have a pretty good deal there. So good luck with that, and let us know how it goes. And if there's any other specific information that we can give you, I think in terms of care, like I mentioned, if you go in the same lines that you would with red cherry shrimp, you'll do well. All right. Now, our next email is from Tom in Provo, Utah. And he says that he has... He knows that Corydoras catfish should be kept in groups, and that he had a group of three sturbi, which were among his favorite fish. Then he vacuumed the gravel, and now has only two. He says, mea culpa. Let him who has never lost a fish in a water change cast the first piece of aquarium gravel. I will be more careful in the future. And I understand that. I've gravel-vacked a couple of fish in my time as well, so I understand. It says, I will be more careful in the future. As for now, I would like to add more Corydoras, but can't find any sturbi locally. Would Corydoras be content in a mixed group, perhaps sturbi and peppered or bronze? Are there any Corydoras that do not mix well, or any that are not unwisely curious about gravel vacuuming tubes? Well, in terms of the gravel vacuuming tubes, I'm not sure what to tell you. As far as mixing the species go, I think there are two considerations. One, just make sure that your temperatures suit both species, because there are, you know, some different tolerances and preferences in terms of temperature for corys. So do a little research on the particular species and find out the preferred temperature ranges. And another thing, I don't think corys exactly will be unhappy in mixed with different species, but they might not school as naturally. I've seen and heard various things on that. One is that people keeping, for example, two or three species of quarries in a very large tank in which the quarries have very large groups, they will tend to stay separate. I haven't seen that personally, but I've heard that. And if you keep a very small number of quarries in a tank, I have seen a friend of mine, for example, I think he had three different species of quarries and only one or two individuals of each, and they tended to loosely hang together, perhaps not as much as they would if they were one species. Now, I have typically only kept one species of quarry together when I have kept large numbers, and I think, well, I've never kept really large numbers, actually. I think the largest group of quarries I ever kept together was nine, and the nine tended to school together fairly well, and I've kept smaller groups, of course. And I would say that if you can wait to get some stirabi, you might, you know, you'll probably get a more natural schooling behavior, but it's I would suspect that the quarry might actually feel a little bit more at ease with another species of similar quarry than it would without any other quarries. That would be my guess. But if any of you quarry keepers out there have had any experiences to the contrary or any information that could contribute to this and help us out here, help Tom out, then please feel free to chime in. Now, Tom's second issue here. Secondly, I'm in a quandary, I guess I should say quandary, not issue, about a couple of 20-gallon-long tanks left to me when a neighbor moved. Both tanks had been used for herps and were unspeakably dirty. Wearing rubber gloves and a face mask, I gave them a basic cleaning. What do I need to do to make them safe for fish? You talked once about procedures for cleaning used betta cups. Multiple cleanings with chlorine solution followed by a cleaning with alcohol and thorough rinses. Will that do it? Well, I would say that if you use, you know, chlorine solution, rinse that thoroughly, and then once that is dry, do the alcohol with 70% alcohol, swab it down, or maybe even better, spray it down, and then let that dry, and then rinse that thoroughly, you'd probably be okay for most pathogens. It says, also of concern is whether these might be tanks specifically made as terrariums and unsuitable as aquariums. Now, that is another issue and a very valid one. Glad you bring that up. They look and feel like aquariums, and at present they do not leak, but I'm concerned that the materials might not be up to aquarium standards. Is that likely? Well, it is true that a number of terraria are marketed specifically for reptiles and therefore not necessarily made to be able to take the weight of water. That's true. You can probably look and see if the silicone in the corners is put together the same way. I've noticed that many of the reptile ones, not all of them, many of them have sort of a black sealant, and it may be a silicone, it may not, I'm not sure, but they'll have a black sealant that has a thinner bead on the inside. And some other cues you can look at, many times the base of the aquarium has a raised area underneath where the the lip or of the frame is raised at part of it, so you can put an under tank heater for a reptile. And if you can see things like that, definitely I would steer away from using them as aquariums. Otherwise, you might be okay. It's hard to tell for sure, but if you do the 24-hour water test, that would be helpful if neither of those other telltale signs show up. And I've bought secondhand aquaria and done the 24-hour water test and then been fine for years thereafter, not knowing actually what was kept in them. So, not that that's necessarily the best way to go, but you're probably okay. And he also says, I continue to enjoy the podcast immensely. Thank you for your hard work and the consistently excellent information. Well, thank you, Tom. We hope that helps a bit, and let us know how that goes and what you decide to do. All right, now we're going to hear from Bob in Boston, starting out with some observations of his cichlids. He says, I have something interesting to report about Discus. Up until now, the male has been eating most of the eggs, followed by nasty internecine squabbling. Now, although the pronunciation may be up for dispute on that word, you definitely win the word of the day. There are several different ways to pronounce that word, but that's my favorite and I believe the most common. And in this case, two of the definitions could apply, because it can refer to particularly violent, deadly sort of aggression, and it can also refer to aggression within a group or conflict within a group. So it kind of fits, because you said it was nasty, and it's between the male discus and his mate, so there you go. Nice use of that word. By adding a rival male to my breeding pair in the 180, I may have diverted his aggression away from the female and her eggs and onto the rival male. Suddenly, the pair is getting along swimmingly, pun intended, and raising their babies. Sometimes they seem almost human to me. I'm also beginning to doubt that discus fry can be raised with any great success from eggs. Without the parents, fry growth is glacial, and with them, growth is phenomenal. The survival rate also shoots way up with the parents. The fact that fish farms in Florida aren't selling discus wholesale suggests to me that they don't lend themselves easily to mass production. And not surprisingly, the world capital for discus is Southeast Asia, which is really just a collection of home breeders and some larger facilities. I've also noticed that German blue rams, Microgeophagus ramirezi, do a slightly better job at raising their fry than I do. They've taken to placing their wrigglers in a planted flower pot filled with organic potting soil. Is this for the infusoria? Whatever the reason is, their babies survive in greater numbers, grow slightly faster, and take baby brine shrimp sooner with the parents. And the eggs also seem less prone to fungus. Well, I kind of have to let that speak for itself. That some great observations on cichlid survival rate, cichlid mortality, when kept with the parents as opposed to when raised artificially. And another thing that Bob said, he thought it would be nice for us to get some more interviews, and he knows someone who actually was involved in the creation of the cockatoo dwarf cichlid. So I'm going to hold off on too much information until we find out whether or not we might get an interview with this individual, but it sounds fascinating, and I hope to hear some good news about that. If it works out, you'll find out more about that, and we'll have a definite cichlid expert on the show, so we'll look into that. And then finally, his PS. I'm pleased that Isaac knew the equation for string theory, but tell him that next time the questions won't be so easy. All right. Well, thanks, Bob, for your contributions today, and we hope to work something out so that we can get interviews on the some dwarf cichlid interviews. So thank you for working on that end of things. All right. Now we'll go to Mick in Carnforth, UK. He says, it was great to hear the interest in dwarf cichlids on the last show. Here are a few quick start points that should be a help. Number one, 10-gallon tank is usually sufficient with a fine layer of sand and leaf litter substrate. Number two, a couple of half clay pots or cut coconut shells as caves. Number three, floating plants such as salvinia or frogbit to give some shade. Number four, sponge or box filters, no powerheads, as this could suck fry up when free swimming. Number five, feed up on bloodworm and quality flake or pellet and feed twice a day. Number six, no tank mates, this only tends to make the pair eat the fry. Number seven, start with cribs. Superb fish, often great parents, and less likely to eat eggs or fry early on. Fry can also be fed directly on Walter worms, powdered flake, or decapsulated brine shrimp eggs. Number eight, after cribs, go on to Epistogramma cacatuoides, another superb fish and a great beginner episto. You would also get to see the dance, display, and lip-locking courtship that cichlids perform to make the pair bond. Number nine, get used to hatching baby brine shrimp and culturing infusoria. Many trickier small cichlids, such as rams, need infusoria for the first week until they can take baby brine shrimp. If hatching brine shrimp is not very practical, then use defrosted cyclops soaked in vitazin or similar vitamin solution. Number 10, have patience. Cribs go quite quickly, but epistos are painfully slow to develop. And now, before we go on to that, I just want to say thank you, Mick, for those pointers on raising dwarf cichlids. And I'm sure Scott will appreciate that as we do. All right, our last contributor for the day is also a first-time contributor. It's Kelly in Shrewsbury in the UK. Kelly says, I stumbled over your podcast a few days ago looking for information on shrimp keeping. I have listened to a few of yours in regards to cherry shrimp and blueberry shrimp, and I was just wondering whether you might do a show just dedicated to shrimp keeping. That's a good idea. I currently have about 12 red cherry shrimp in my community 230-liter tank, but I am currently setting up a shrimp-only tank as I have found that I actually love the shrimp more than the fish. Well, that happens to a lot of us. It would be nice if you could name the different types of freshwater shrimp and the difficulty levels of keeping. I am struggling to decide which type to put in my shrimp-only setup. Considering blue pearl, blue tiger, plain old red cherry. I'm hoping to possibly sell off some of the offspring eventually to local pet shops, as they seem quite rare here in Shrewsbury. We only seem to get red cherry, and not that often. I'm a novice when it comes to aquariums. Keep up the great work, Kelly. Okay, well, thank you, Kelly, and welcome to the show. A few things that we need to address here. One, we ought to do a shrimp-only show sometime. It's probably beyond the scope of what we have left of the podcast today, so we'll try to see if we can do that. It's a great idea. But just to get you started, I might suggest some information from planetinverts.com. They have a great shrimp section. If you go there, they'll mention, they usually have the scientific name that goes with each species or variety, as the case may be. And they have some good information on blue pearl and blue tiger, as well as the red cherry shrimp. In general, I'd recommend red cherry shrimp first, just to get used to things, because, first of all, they're less expensive, so if there are any issues there, you have lost less. And that may seem like kind of a harsh attitude, maybe, in terms of the shrimp, because, you know, they're all shrimp and they're all lives, but in terms of your investment, if you do have any problems, it's going to be less of a drain on your pocket, I guess, as a practical matter. And they do tend to be very hardy as well, hardier than some of the other shrimp, so that might be a way to go. Some of the others are equally as hardy, but among the many varieties, there are quite a few that are not as hardy as red cherry shrimp. They're also easier to find, as you have found, and you have some. So I would say, initially, set up your shrimp-only tank for your red cherry shrimp and see how that goes for a while. And then if you have some success with that, I would say that you could probably go to some of the other a little bit more expensive varieties. And in the meantime, we'll see if we can set up a shrimp-only show. So, Kelly, welcome to Aquarimax as a contributor, and we hope that that helped and that we'll be able to help you some more in the future. Mick has also provided the long-awaited shrimp news. He says he finally got a peppermint shrimp for his marine tank, and it cleaned up all the Uptasia anemones. Huzzah! Next step, the coral shop. Also, white pearl shrimp update. We discussed this with when we were talking about the shrimp reproduction a few weeks ago, that his white pearl shrimp hadn't been reproducing as well as he had expected. He had found a few shrimplets, but not very many. Says he's getting good numbers of buried females, but the shrimplets only seem to last a few days, then just disappear. At a loss as to why I am keeping a dark side of the tank, as I am keeping a dark side of the tank covered in algae, which the newly hatched shrimp seem to graze on at first, then just vanish. It's a shrimp-only tank, so nothing to eat them. Best fishes, Mick. Yeah, that is a weird situation. You're seeing the newly hatched ones, and then they disappear. You know, this is something that I've heard around. I don't know if it's possible, but some people say that amphipods can actually eat newly hatched or newly released red cherry shrimp and similar shrimp. I don't know if you have any of those in that tank. I'm wondering about that in my tank. I have had a somewhat of a population explosion lately of a red cherry shrimp, and they're doing fairly well, but not all of the young reach adult size. Some of them are, and some of them are maturing, and so I'm getting quite a number of them, but not as many as I might expect based on the number of newly released shrimplets that I see. But I also have had a boom in the numbers of amphipods in the tank to such an extent that they're actually starting to nibble on the plants to an extent that damages them. Not as much on the, like, the rotala, things like that, but the frog bit, they're definitely going after the frog bit. They're going after the older cryptocoryne leaves, and let's see, anything else that's really bothering? Well, of course, the Java moss. They're nibbling on that quite a bit. So this is what I have done. I started trying to trap them, and that wasn't too successful. It worked a little bit, but not so much. And, of course, the reason why they're reproducing so crazily in the tank is because there aren't any fish to eat them. There are a couple of coolie loaches in there and some bristlenose plecos, and that's it. The rest of the inhabitants in terms of animal life are red cherry shrimp and a few assassin snails. So they're just proliferating. So out of desperation, I put an African dwarf frog in there. I know it will probably eat quite a few of the shrimp, but it will hopefully get the amphipods down to a manageable level, and then I can move it, and if I have to rotate it between tanks, at least I can keep the amphipods down somewhat. In my experience, when I keep, for example, my 5-gallon tank at work, if I keep just African dwarf frogs in there, the shrimp will do okay. They'll maintain a stable population, a sustainable population, I should say, and they do all right. If I put a bed in there, the population usually persists, but at a very low level. And so I'm hoping that one frog in a 20-gallon hive that's full of a lot of hiding places and plants will preserve the plants in the tank and help the red cherry shrimp to continue to exist and do okay, even if he does pick off some of them. I'm sure he will. But it's very difficult to find any other species. I can't think of any fish that I could put in there that would not eat the baby red cherry shrimp and would eat the amphipod. So I think it's making the best of a bad job, so to speak. It's a difficult situation. Oh, in other news, I should mention that I got a UV sterilizer hooked up in a 55-gallon tank. I mentioned that I had purchased one, but not that I had set it up, because I hadn't set it up last podcast. It is, I've got the box right over here. The model is apparently a JUP23, and it doesn't actually have a very obvious brand name on it, but it was what I believe used to be the brand that Diana Wallstedt recommended, and the brand name has now been acquired by this company that has an interesting logo but not a very obvious name. But at any rate, I hope that it works well. It seems to be working well so far. I haven't noticed any particular differences in the tank yet, but I haven't had it in there very long, and the differences that I hoped to make were not ones that would be visible very soon, because I'm not combating algae or anything of the sort. I'm just hoping to basically do what Diana Wallstedt recommends using these filters for. At least one of the recommendations she has is to combat mycobacteriosis. And though I haven't had really problems in this tank with mycobacteriosis for some time, I just want to hedge my bet and make sure that we deal with the problem and eliminate numbers of the mycobacteria that could be a problem, basically, in the tank. So I'll let you know how that goes, and how the frog does with the shrimp and the amphipods. And I think that's about all for this week, so may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.